All right, hello everyone. Hope everyone had a good long weekend for those of us who are in the U.S. So we'll start this week's CCG meeting. Before we start, I'll just go into the Code of Ethics and Professional Conduct reminder. The details are included in the agenda that sent out last week. More or less, just be respectful to each other. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to the CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. And you can join the CCG community from the links in the agenda that you send out, or email any of the co-chairs. My email is harrison@spokeo.com, S-P-O-K-E-O.com. All right, so all the meetings are being recorded, and there's transcriptions that will be sent out this week. We got the transcription process working now, so it'll be sent out about a day or 2 days after the meeting. You can use the GC chat to queue the speakers during the call. You can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue, or Q- to remove yourself to the queue. You can do a queue question to see who's in the queue. All right, let's go into the introductions or reintroductions. Anyone want to introduce yourself, or maybe you haven't been active in the community and want to reintroduce yourself? Please just come on me. All right, I'll cue the introductions and reintroduction at the end of the meeting again for those who are a little bit shy or don't know what to say at this moment. All right, so for this week, our agenda is we're pleased to invite Marcus from the New Tech to present the state of DID resolution as at the meeting today. Marcus, obviously, most of us know, has been an active contributor to the CCG community, and we're very, very pleased to have him speak. But before then, thank you, Kalia, for reminding me. I forgot about the announcements. So any announcements or reminders? Kalia.
Sure. Thanks. So I just wanted to share again, we've got the working with New Logic in Thailand to produce the APAC Digital Identity Unconference. We just changed the venue, but it's still happening, and I think it's going to be really fantastic. Lots of interest from people around the region. So if you have staff in the region or know folks working in the region that could connect up with the broader community, that would be great to share it with them. I'll put the link in the chat. And also in mid-March, I'm producing the Thoughtful Biometrics workshop to support uncommon conversations about this slightly controversial technology, and would invite identity people who are interested in engaging in that conversation to join. So I'll post both those links. And of course, usual IAW has registration open now, April 18th to 20th in the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. Thank you.
Thank you, Kalia. Any other announcements or reminders? All right, before we get to the main agenda, there's also some requests on the questions on the work items. The first work item is the evidence property. I don't see David's on today, so maybe we can talk about that next week. Manu, any questions on the work items?
Nope.
Okay, cool. And then the second one is there's also questions last time about 2 weeks, a couple weeks ago, about the DID link resources specification. So if there's questions, please just add the comments on GitHub, or we can reopen that item because I don't see Alex on as well. But we actually, in our CCG calendar, we have the DID link resources specification topic scheduled for February 21st. So we can also talk about that. All right. So let's get to the main agenda. So as I mentioned earlier, we're very, very honored to have Marcus here to talk about the state of DID resolution. Marcus has been very active, and he's kind enough to contribute the DID resolution test suite to the CCG last September. So without further ado, Marcus, you have the floor.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Perfect. Perfect.
All right, then I will try to share my screen. All right, is that working?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. So yeah, thanks, Harrison. Thanks for the invitation. As you said, I'm Marcus. I'm one of the co-editors of the DID core specification and the DID resolution specification, which I guess we'll talk about a little bit now. How long should this be, Harrison? How much time should I?
You can take as much time as you want. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I try to prepare this in a way where I'm not starting from scratch, right? So I'm not going to explain all the foundations of DIDs and DID documents. I assume everybody knows most of that. Everybody probably knows that DID resolution is the process of taking a DID and getting the DID document associated with the DID. So I'm not going to explain all of this in detail, but I thought I'm going to start just as some motivation to remind ourselves how important and how fundamental DID resolution really is, because it happens essentially all the time, right? If we do anything with verifiable credentials or CHAPI or DIDCOM or OpenID Connect, it's always DID resolution. There's always a need to discover the DID document, to discover metadata about the subject that's identified by the DID. So here are some common examples that probably everyone here is familiar with, but just as some inspiration in a verifiable credential, if we want to verify the proof on a verifiable credential, we need to resolve the issuer DID to look up the issuer's public key. If we perform some kind of DID auth, flow DID auth interaction, whether it's based on CHAPI or DIDCOM or OpenID Connect, there's always some kind of challenge response pattern, and there's some kind of signature signed by someone who's identified by a DID. So again, we need to resolve the DID. And of course, we also need to resolve DIDs for discovering somebody's DIDCOM endpoint or decentralized web node or some other kind of service. So it's really a very fundamental function. And because of that, there are also a lot of implementations out there, right? This is just a very small subset of the implementations that somehow implement the DID resolution process. There's the DIF Universal Resolver, which is a resolver that can be run as a service. And then there are several libraries, Veramo, DidKit, Hyperledger, Aries, TypeScript, Resolver. So the resolvers, implementations of DID resolution, they come in different forms and different languages. And sometimes they are standalone components, and sometimes DID resolution is built into something else. So there's a lot of variety and quite a lot of implementations, because DIDs and DID resolution are so fundamental to other things. How is this defined right now? So how do we know how DID resolution works? And the answer is, there's a little bit of content in the DID core specification, which as we know is a W3C recommendation. It has an entire section about resolution, and it also has a section about the identifier, of course, which talks a little bit about DID parameters. So these are some things that we have in the DID core specification that have to do with with deed resolution, there's a definition of some functions, resolve function, resolve representation, dereferencing functions, and these functions specify what is the input and what is the output. So, for example, if we resolve a deed, then there's really the deed as one input and resolution options as another input. And then as an output, we get the deed document, but we also get two types of metadata, deed resolution metadata, deed document metadata. And some of that is also defined in deed core already. So this is already a standard. It defines some resolution option called accept. It defines some resolution metadata called content type and error, and some deed document metadata about the deed document, when was it created, when was it updated, and so on. And then, as I said, there are also some deed parameters. So deed parameters are part of a deed URL, right? So if we have a not just a deed, but a deed URL with a path and a query string and fragment, then deed core also defines the syntax of that, and it defines some of these deed parameters. Now what the deed core standard doesn't define, it doesn't actually define how this is really implemented in deed core. These things related to deed resolution are defined in an abstract way. They are abstract interfaces with some abstract data structures, but the deed core specification doesn't define, for example, a concrete algorithm. If we look at this example here, it says deed X 1234, and then there's a parameter called service. Then deed core defines that there is this parameter called service, and it defines a little bit what it means, but deed core doesn't define how you actually dereference this. If you dereference this, what exactly happens, what exactly is the output. And also here, for example, if we have a fragment. So that's missing in deed core. Another thing that's missing is concrete representations or data formats for the deed resolution results and the deed URL dereferencing results with all this metadata, right? In deed core, we specify representations and how to express a deed document, but we don't really define a data format or a representation or a serialization of these other things, the metadata. So this is also just mentioned in an abstract way, but is not really defined how to implement that or what that looks like. And then what's also not in deed core is some how you can invoke a resolver, how you can call a resolver. So it doesn't define a binding over HTTP or over DITCOM or over some other protocol. That's because DIT resolution is an abstract function, right? It's not one single protocol as we have it in DNS, for example. In DNS, there are DNS servers and there are clients, and there's a well-defined client-server protocol. And deed resolution is different because it's an abstract function, and deed core doesn't actually define how you can invoke or how you can call a resolver. So some of these things are being addressed, or we've been trying to fill in some of these missing pieces, some of these missing links in deed resolution specification, which is a draft, a community draft document. It's a work item in CCG. It's not a final specification, but it's trying to add some of these missing pieces. For example, it tries to define more concrete algorithms. So if you resolve a deed, if you dereference a deed URL, then what exactly happens? And here are just some examples from some exemplary pieces of those algorithms. For example, here it says determine if the did method of the input did is supported by the did resolver. And if not, the did resolver must return the following result. So you can see here that the fact that there is did resolution metadata and did document and did document metadata, that's already in did core. And this error property that's also defined in did core. And the meaning of these things is also defined in did core, but did core doesn't actually, provide a concrete instructions. What happens when, right? If then else, if the input is in a certain way, then the resolver or the dereferencer should behave in a certain way and produce a certain output. Here's another example. If the DDURL contains a parameter called service and maybe a parameter called relative ref, then the fact that these parameters exist and what they mean, that is indeed core, but did core doesn't tell us how to actually process them and what the concrete outcome is if you dereference them. And some other things like what happens if you have fragments and what errors are returned and so on. So did resolution is trying to fill in these more concrete algorithms and instructions. It also defines a data format of the entire did resolution result and DDURL dereferencing result. So in did core, we only define representations of the did document, but the other things, did resolution, metadata, did document, metadata in did core are only defined in an abstract way, but doesn't define how you can represent the whole thing in JSON or JSON LD. It's kind of obvious, right? If you look at it, it seems very straightforward and obvious anyway, but still it's probably something that should be explicitly defined. Another thing that's in the resolution specification is an HTTP binding or HTTPS binding. How can you call a resolver if that resolver is exposed as an HTTP endpoint? And here again, it's important to point out that this is not like DNS, right? Where did resolution doesn't have to happen by calling a remote service, right? So sometimes people look at the universal resolver, for example. That's a relatively well-known project, but this universal resolver project at DIF is run as a service, as a remote endpoint that you can call over an HTTP binding. But it's important to point out that did resolution, this is just one way how did resolution can work, right? Did resolution can also just be an entirely local process where you don't have to rely on any external service. But still, in some cases, it can be useful to have a binding or in this case, an HTTP interface to a resolver. And that's also one thing that we've been working on in the did resolution specification. You can see some examples here. It looks relatively straightforward. It basically says that you can execute HTTP GET requests and you pass in the did and then you get back the did resolution result, the did document plus the metadata. And the headers play a certain role, so you can use HTTP headers and you can also pass additional parameters over HTTP in the URL. And this binding tries to map this HTTP API to the abstract resolution and dereferencing functions that are in the did core specification. And even though this looks relatively simple, there are some There are some details that are not so straightforward. So, for example, in DID core, there is a difference between resolving a DID and dereferencing a DID URL. And one question is if over HTTP, if these two functions should be, if those two functions can be exposed at a single HTTP endpoint, or if you maybe want two different HTTP endpoints, one for resolving and one for dereferencing. And how exactly do you pass the resolution options? How exactly do you get back the metadata? Do you map the options that you have on the DID resolution level? Do you map those to HTTP headers, or do you just send them in an HTTP body? So there are some details that are not as straightforward as it seems. But anyway, this is also one of the things that we've been trying to work on in DID resolution specification. One more thing, there's some sections, a little bit of content about architectures. So again, keeping in mind that DID resolution implementations come in different forms. Sometimes DID resolution is just a local library. Sometimes it's a remote service. Sometimes you have hybrid architectures where maybe you're running a DID resolver locally and it can resolve certain DID methods locally, but it can use a remote resolver as a fallback for DID methods that you cannot resolve locally. And then there are always a lot of questions about how you can trust the resolver and how a client can verify if you get back the correct result. So there's a section also that tries to discuss some of these architectural or the topology, right? How the different local and remote components talk to each other. And I don't know, should I just keep going, or are there any questions so far?
I don't see anybody in the queue, so yeah, please keep going. Thanks.
Okay. So this so far has been an overview of what's in the different specifications, DID core and DID resolution, how those can relate and complement each other. And now I have a few slides about, since this is called the current state of DID resolution, I have a few slides about some interesting topics that we've seen in the last few weeks and last few months on what we are learning about DID resolution, or what people in the community have been doing with these DID resolution interfaces. And so, for example, we've seen a lot of extensions, a lot of new ideas for resolution options, for DID parameters, for metadata properties and error codes. And here's a list of some of these extensions that are not in DID core and not in the DID resolution specification, but that have been defined elsewhere. For example, a parameter called initial state, where you can pass some information to a resolver about the initial content of the DID document. There's a parameter called transform keys, where you can instruct the resolver to convert the public key representations in the DID document, let's say between an ED25519 verification key 2018. You could convert that to a ED25519 verification key 2020 or to a JSON web key. So this is something that a resolver could perform if it supports some of these extensions. A few new error codes have been proposed. Method not supported, that's not in did core, but it seems useful for a resolver to indicate if it doesn't support a certain method. Internal error, not allowed method, not allowed verification method type, invalid public key. So I've seen several proposals and developments where a DID resolver could be considered a point of where policies can be enforced and where some kind of validation can happen. How you could configure a DID resolver in a way that it enforces certain policies where it can accept or reject certain requests or certain deeds or certain deed methods depending on policies and depending on properties of those deeds and deed methods. You could, for example, automatically return an error if a weak public key is detected in a deed document, right? So a resolver could resolve the deed and then it could check all the public keys in the deed document, and if those are considered weak or if a duplicate key has been detected, it could be considered an error or a warning. Or a deed resolver could automatically validate if the deed document conforms to the specification, and if it's missing something, or if a JSON-LD context is missing, or if an ID value is invalid, and then the resolver could also indicate that and perform some validation.
By the way, Marcus, we have Sandy in the queue for questions.
Yes.
Sandy, please.
Okay.
Sandy, we cannot hear you.
I'm sorry. How about now? Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, sorry for that. So my question is, and again, I'm sorry if this question has already been addressed earlier, but my question is, so in high confidence situations where you really need to make sure that the resolver is dependable and it's not been compromised, is there any provision where you require the signature of the resolver itself to be verified?
Yes, that has to do with this section here, DID resolution architectures. There is a section about this in the DID resolution specification. Maybe looking at that last diagram here where you have a client, the client calls a local resolver using some library, and then that local resolver maybe calls a remote resolver over an HTTP binding. And then how can the client be sure that the resolver returns the correct data? And there are really at least two sub-questions or sub-topics. The first topic is, does the resolver actually retrieve the correct DID document according to the DID method? And the second question is, does the DID resolver actually return that same DID document, or does the DID resolver manipulate the DID document? So what are the different threat models and different attacks that can be considered? What you mentioned, that the DID resolver could sign the result and return it to the client, that's one something that can certainly be done. That is also mentioned in the specification, but it's always important to be aware of what does that protect from and what does it not protect from, right? So if the DID resolver signs the result, then it doesn't solve the problem of a potentially malicious DID resolver, right? So that maybe prevents some man-in-the-middle attack or something like that, where a client could verify that the resolution result has been signed by the resolver and it hasn't been manipulated since then, but that doesn't really solve the problem of, is it really the right DID document for the DID, right? So that's a separate question, and there are some considerations about that as well. You could query multiple resolvers and compare the results, or you could include in the deed resolution metadata, you could include some state proofs or some kind of method-specific proof information, which then the client could independently verify. But that's what this section is for, to discuss and consider some of these topics that come with different resolution architectures.
Right. So thank you, Marcus. So I think, like you said, I think the question I have is more not so much to prevent the man-in-the-middle attack, but how do we make sure that the resolver hasn't been compromised? Because, I mean, it's very much possible that the resolver may return correct data for some amount of time, you know, to establish confidence. But then, when, you know, in a different situation, it may provide a different, data. So I guess the question here becomes, and again, my apologies if this has already been addressed, but the question here becomes that does a resolver, when you're passing the dead method over to the resolver, can we necessitate some sort of a signature verification that, you know, well, I'm indeed passing this on to, or actually it might be coming back from the resolver as a part of that. So this way, any response coming back to the resolver is signed with a specific thing, which is already, you know, kind of like signed with the resolver's private key, and the public key is already there with the requester, with the client. So this way the requester knows that it's coming only from that resolver, nobody else.
Yeah, so that is certainly possible. The resolver can sign the result, and then the client knows or can verify that the result indeed comes from that resolver. But it doesn't solve the issue of a compromised resolver, right? If the resolver itself is compromised, then it could return a bad the document and sign the bad the document, and then the client knows that the result comes indeed from that resolver, but the client still doesn't know if it's been, if the resolver itself is compromised or
well, not. It would, right? Because I mean, if the resolver is compromised, a signature is not going to be able to match. So obviously it's going to know, you know, any document signed by that different thing will basically not bear the same signature anymore.
Marcus, do you mind if I jump in and add a comment?
Yeah, sure.
I think the Sandy, helpful thing to think about with regards to resolver is that it is, you must always consider a trusted backend architecture. So your concern is correct, but I think you're thinking of the resolver more as an external component. It is, regardless of how it's deployed, it is very much an internal trusted component. So you have to use the same techniques that you usually use to secure other trusted internal microservices, whether it's just IP filtering, whether you're adding like OAuth 2 authentication, HTTP signatures, all of those techniques go. But it is definitely a trusted component. Thanks.
Understood. Thank you. So you're basically saying, Dimitri, your point being that, yes, it's underneath the same, you know, the umbrella and the, you know, circumference of trust. So,
yeah, exactly.
Understood. All right, thank you.
Thanks. Right, so the best scenario is probably where the resolver is just a local library, right? So where it's not even a remote service. That's probably best. Also from a perspective of decentralization, if the resolver is not running locally. And second best is probably if you use a remote resolver that you control or that you're self-hosting, and relying on a third-party resolver, of course, comes with some security and trust.
Yeah.
Risk.
If I may just leave two foods for thought here, two thoughts here. Basically, I mean, essentially, yes, agreed. In general, like, it'd be the trusted circumference and the trusted, basically, ring-fenced sort of environment. But, like, yeah, I guess we understand that there could be compromised accounts and compromised keys. And the second thing is, I think just from a future point of view, I think how much of this could be quantum safe in the sense that, like, we're assuming that any public keys cannot be reverse engineered because of the current encryption strengths, but can we depend on that for the next 10, 20 years? I mean, we don't have to answer the question right now, but I'm just thinking out loud.
Yep. Good input. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to you.
Last comment I will make just about these architectures is that, like I said, we think of a remote resolver with an HTTP interface just as one possible way how resolution works. Ideally, resolution is just a local process, but there can also be other protocols and other bindings. So, for example, we've also specified a DITCOM binding. So you can also call a resolver over DITCOM, and then you have all the security and trust benefits that you have maybe in DITCOM, including mutually authenticated communication based on DITs themselves. So you can use that also for communicating between resolvers. Okay, but the point that I wanted to make here on this slide is just some innovation that we've been seeing recently in terms of new parameters, options, error codes, functionality that a resolver can perform. We've already heard today about this recent proposal by Checked and some others. I think that was also discussed on the CCG call recently about the linked resources specification with some proposed DIT parameters that can be included in a DIT URL, in this case to identify a schema, a resource with a certain name and type. And so this is also DIT URL dereferencing, right? So DIT resolution and DIT URL dereferencing are really extensible mechanisms that can have where new functionality and new potential behavior and outputs can be added. And the trick or the ambition of the DIT resolution specification is to provide some framework or some generic algorithm that is pluggable and extensible where anyone can, any use case or any DIT method or any application can come up with their own ways of using DIT URLs, right? So that we can add new functionality. Here's another example we see in the work that's happening on decentralized web nodes. This is especially interesting, I think, because here's an example of a DIT URL where one of the DIT parameters service is already defined in DIT core, whereas this one is an extension that, as far as I know, is defined by decentralized web nodes. And so service is a parameter that selects a service endpoint from the DIT document. And queries is then something that's applied to the decentralized web node that you find at that service. So here's an interesting way of using DIT URLs where part of the dereferencing logic involves the DIT document and another part of the logic involves the service that you select from the DIT document. It's also interesting to mention that some of these parameters, some of the dereferencing logic tends to be DIT method specific. It only works with some DIT methods, and whereas some of these parameters are DIT method independent that work with all DIT methods. So there's a lot of logic and interesting functionality that can be done. Here are some more examples of some recent developments in the area of DIT resolution, some DIT methods, DIT carry, DIT self, and version 2 of DIT EPSI. What all of them have in common is that it's not so easy to resolve the DITs unless you have some additional information. So for example, this DIT self or DIT EPSI version 2, in this case, the method specific identifier is a JWK thumbprint. So that means you cannot resolve this to a DID document unless you already have the DID document and some other information. We've been discussing this on different calls and different communities because this feels really strange, right? We are used to the idea that if we have a DID, we can immediately resolve it. We just go to a web server or to a blockchain or to some API and we retrieve the DID document for the DID. Whereas here the DIDs require some additional information. So you basically already need the DID document in order to be able to resolve the DID to the DID document. That sounds really strange, but I think it actually fits into the framework. I think it's totally legitimate to do these things. It just means that when you call the resolver, you have to pass the DID plus additional resolution options, right? And that's then depends on the DID method, but it still fits into the overall framework of DIDs. And the same is true for DID carry. So carry is something that's getting a lot of attention. The key event receipt infrastructure, a new and innovative way of managing keys, and in this technology, you have an identifier, and there's also not immediately a way to resolve it. You typically need something called an UBI, an out of band introduction, which lets you discover witnesses and watchers. I'm not an expert on carry, but also here the identifier is not enough, and so you need to define some additional parameters, some additional options in order to be able to resolve it. So I think this is also quite interesting to have these new ways of or innovative DID methods. And then I'm almost done here, a third slide, that as we work on DID resolution, we are encountering again some maybe not so easy topics from that we already had in the DID working group, some uncertainties, unanswered questions maybe around different representations and media types. There's a GitHub issue where a media type that Manu opened, I think, about on the DID core specification about how to handle media types, for example, in the DID web method. So what we're seeing here is if you resolve a DID web identifier, then typically the resolution process looks like this, where you retrieve a document called did.json over HTTP, and then in many cases this will be on the HTTP level, this will be returned as application/json, but it includes this add context is wrong, this should actually be the standard DID core context. But anyway, you get back a DID document in a JSON-LD form with an application/JSON header, but this is not really one of the media types defined in the DID core specification, which defines these media types. So there's a little challenge here. I wonder if maybe the DID resolution work can make some of this easier, but anyway, also something to be aware of. And then last slide. So what's now the current state of this DID resolution? As I said, is a work item in the CCG. It's a draft community report. Like I said, it covers some algorithms, some data formats, some extensions, some architectural considerations. It is definitely not done, so it needs more work. It probably some things need to be added, some things need to be fixed. There are 45 open issues. There is also the test suite, so we contributed that a few months ago, a deep resolution test suite, which is different from the DIT test suite, right? So there's a DIT test suite that tests the DIT core specification. And the idea of the DIT resolution test suite is to test the DIT resolution specification. There is some overlap, but it's really a little bit different. So with this, you can test a resolver endpoint and see if it behaves correctly.
By the way, Marcus, we have Ryan on the queue for questions.
Yeah, just the last thing. This is really the last thing. There is now a proposed charter for the next DIT working group, and that says that the working group will begin working toward a specification for DIT resolution and DIT URL dereferencing. So that's a place where this work can hopefully continue. And that's it. Thank you. And yes, more questions.
Hi, Marcus. Thank you very much. I have a question. It seems there are different requirements for different resolver deployment architectures. So how could the DIT resolution specification prioritize between, on the one hand, clarity of specification for a simple architecture as may be required to move the DIT working group past a privately threatened formal objection versus convenience features for certain network reliant architectures?
I think I don't think that the resolution specification should have a lot of requirements that depend on the architecture. I think everything that it says and mentions about, for example, the algorithm, how is the DIT URL processed, when are certain error codes returned, how is the metadata being used. I don't think this has much to do with the architecture. It doesn't make much of a difference if it's an entirely local resolver or it's a remote resolver. There is a section about these architectures in the DIT resolution specification, but those sections don't really change the behavior or the algorithms or the requirements of how DIT resolution really works. It just adds some security considerations and architectural considerations, and it's not finished, right? So if you actually look at the document, you will see a lot of open issues and ideas that still have to be completed. But I'm not sure exactly what you mean about preventing formal objections. Can you clarify?
Sure. I think one of the ways that the DIT working group could move forward, as discussed at TPAC, would be to focus on DIT resolution. And the threatened formal objection that I referred to was the prior formal objections, and that they would be repeated if there was not a DIT method chosen. But there is not consensus on choosing a DIT method. So I was asking what kind of the minimal set of clarity of specification would be, and for instance, does the DIT resolution spec need to choose an example architecture that it answers certain questions for in order to dissolve the formal objections?
Well, first, I don't think that the resolution specification should mention any specific DIT method. So I know that there's an ongoing discussion whether or not the you did working group should standardize DIP methods, and if yes, which ones, or no DIP methods at all. I consider that completely separate and independent from the DIP resolution specification. The DIP resolution specification should not mention any specific DIP method, and it should also not do anything or make any assumptions that would favor certain DIP methods or certain DIP method architectures. When I mentioned architectures here, I meant not architectures of the DIP method. So it's not about DIP web versus DIP key versus a blockchain-based DIP method. This is more about the architecture of the resolver, right? Is the resolver hosted locally? Is the resolver hosted at an HTTP endpoint? But this has nothing to do with how the DIP method works, and I think this should be completely neutral and not do anything that favors or makes any assumptions about how the DIP method itself works.
If I could just tag on to perhaps clear up any misunderstanding, I wasn't trying to bring that into this specification. The direction of my question was that this specification could become more important as one way to dissolve the roadblock in the DID working group in a way that also satisfies other concerns about not picking DID method winners and losers. So if this DID resolution specification was becoming more important, then my question would be, is it helpful to pick a deployment architecture as an example implementation so that people who would otherwise formally object, such as the prior formal objectors, see that it is clear what packets need to be sent over the wire to, or not over the wire, if we choose a different deployment architecture, in order to fully get a resolution from a DID. That's all.
Yes, I mean, I think this is something that the specification could discuss. I mean, that there's a little bit of that already here in this section. It does mention and illustrate with diagrams certain deployment architectures. If you want, and tries to discuss a little bit what are the risks and the potential threats of certain architectures. So I don't know, maybe again take the universal resolver as an example. If you go to uniresolver.io, that's a relatively well-known service in the community, and a lot of people use that, but you should not use that except for experimentation, maybe, because it is a third-party hosted service that could be unreliable, that could manipulate the results. And so this kind of thing, this I think would be in scope to discuss and describe a little bit these different architectures. Is that what you mean, or?
I'm just asking questions about what this specification could do to prioritize in a way that would make it a viable answer for finishing it in the DID working group. And as the current DID working group charter specifies.
Mm-hmm.
The proposed charter.
Yeah.
Cool. Any other questions for Marcus? All right. Thank you, Marcus. Thanks for your great presentation on DID resolution. One quick question for David. David, you mentioned you would like to talk about evidence properties. I'm just wondering, you know, how long will that take? And also, do you want to, if it's long, then we probably should put that in the agenda.
Yeah. Well, actually, I won't be here next week. I'm traveling. But basically, there is a draft, and all we're wanting to do is to standardize what the type would be. Because as you know, the verifiable credential allows any evidence to be specified of any type. And so we'd just like to standardize one type, which refers to the OpenID Foundation's existing draft specification on identity assurance. So they've actually, there's been a working group working for, you know, a year or more on how do you assure identity and what evidence do you need to assure identity. So they've got a whole standard on this. And what we'd like to do is import it into verifiable credential by saying, if you have this particular type of evidence, then it means you are using the OpenIDF standard for evidence. That's essentially it, the new work item.
Got it. Okay. Maybe I can coordinate with you over email offline, and then perhaps we could even get the OpenID folks to join our meetings to kind of describe this topic a little bit further.
Yeah, yeah. What's really interesting that came out from it, actually, is that when presenting evidence, they're actually presenting a whole raft of evidence. So if you consider somebody's name, the evidence might be, I took the name David Jones from the passport, and I took the name David Jones Smith from their driving license. And now you see you've got different evidence with different names, because over time someone might have changed their name, or, you know, by deed poll or whatever. And so there are two things that come out here. One is that the evidence value, the evidence values presented may not be the same as the actual value in the verifiable credential because of changes to them. And the second thing is that the evidence is somehow duplicating information in the verifiable credential, such that if you were to do selective disclosure of the verifiable credential, but not selective disclosure of the evidence, you may actually be revealing in the evidence information that you didn't want to reveal in the selective disclosure. So that's a really interesting, thorny problem for people to discuss.
Thank you. Thanks. All right, we're almost at time. Any last announcements, reminders, or reintroductions? All right, thanks a lot. Have a good one. Bye.